Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Freeman, and I'll be chairing today's event. On behalf of the LaRouche PAC, I'd like to welcome all of you here today, both those of you who are gathered here in our audience in Washington and those of you who are listening via the Internet. If there are people here who would prefer to listen to the webcast in Spanish, you can pick up a receiver at the table in the rear of the room. And also, if there is anyone here who might be hearing impaired, you can also do the same thing. And you can listen in English. On behalf of LaRouche PAC members all over the nation, I'd like to extend congratulations to two LaRouche PAC and LIM leaders in California who this weekend won elections and now hold posts in the California Democratic Party. It's Quincy Jones and Emilio Inocentes. I think, what'd I say? Quincy Jones, oh man. Thank goodness it wasn't Quincy Jones. Then the country would really be in trouble. But in addition to those excellent developments, and developments which I think mean that we now can actually expect some action and some leadership from the California Democratic Party, which is the largest Democratic organization in the United States, we had other significant developments as well. The Louisiana Democratic Party's Executive Committee, at the initiative of Fred Uhlenfeld, passed a resolution demanding that Congress expedite the impeachment of Dick Cheney. In California, after a hard-fought fight, the LaRouche youth movement out there did in fact succeed in getting the impeachment question inserted into the resolution that was passed by the state party. And over the course of the same weekend, there were over 100 impeachment actions across the United States whose theme was, above all, Cheney first. And that is a very pleasant development. I think that those developments have to be seen in the context of events here in the United States and, in fact, internationally. And there is no question that they are a product of Mr. LaRouche's initiatives and the work done by his movement here in the U.S. What I think we're seeing now is the crystallization of the anger and frustration of the American population and of their response to real leadership when it's offered. And I think that that provides a very useful nudge to our representatives on Capitol Hill. And I think without question, today's event will serve to be an even more heartfelt nudge that'll be felt not only in the area of their rear ends, but also between their ears. I have other things that I can say to you, but I will say them later. Right now, without any further introduction, I'd like to present Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. Thank you, young lady. What I'm about to announce to you, followed up by a presentation on the subject, will produce incredulity in a lot of people around the world, around the country, especially inside the United States. But it's all true, and I shall indicate to you what some of you may not have taken into account or didn't know about the nature of the world situation. And therefore, you would have doubts about what I'm about to tell you. The situation now is such that the present world monetary financial system is so far embedded into a process of hopeless bankruptcy. There's no way the system in its present form could ever come back or could survive. It's gone. The very question of the value of money is in doubt to everyone who knows what is going on. What must happen if civilization is to be continued on this planet? It must happen very rapidly. Is that the United States must enter into an agreement with Russia, China, India, and other countries to establish immediately an emergency new international monetary system based in conception on the precedent of Franklin Roosevelt's launching of the Bretton Woods system in the period 1944-45. That must happen and can happen. Russia has already indicated through President Putin repeatedly and through others, and I have some considerable investigation into this matter, of an interest in working together with the United States, perhaps not with the jokers who are presently sitting in Washington in the White House and similar places, but to establish a new relationship with the United States different than that which exists now at the top, in order to bring together the nations of Russia, China, India, and the United States, and other nations into treaty agreements which will establish immediately a new emergency world monetary system modeled in intention on the agreement which Franklin Roosevelt orchestrated in 1944-45 for the post-war world. That is the only option for humanity now. The time frame is immediate. This is not something for 2009 or even 2008. It's for 2007. And it must happen now. Because the entire system is presently hopelessly bankrupt. It's being held together by pins and needles and gum, a chewing gum. Perhaps, I don't know whose chewing gum it is, but it's sticking out of the seat. So. Check your seat for chewing gum. Now, what happened was, of course, the system, in a conventional sense, went bankrupt in October of 1987, which I had the privilege of predicting earlier that year, as an early October collapse of the monetary financial system in the U.S. It happened. What happened was the equivalent of the Hoover Depression breakout in 1929. What happened then at that point is that a fellow called Alan Greenspan, who was not known for clarity, announced that since he had been nominated to become the new chairman of the monetary system, of the Federal Reserve System, he announced to Volcker, who was incumbent still then, and to others, hold everything, I'm coming. And he said, wait, and I'll fix it. Now what he did when he came in, he launched the wildest fraud you could imagine. Instead of facing the reality that we had gone into a 1929 depression already, he said, we're going to keep the thing alive with what was later called a wall of money, of fake printing press money, generated more and more, not in the form of printed paper, but in the form of electronic fantasies. Agreements based on nothing. The two of the things that were crucial in this were, first of all, they turned the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and similar institutions into a mechanism for financing based on mortgage-based securities. A wild-eyed speculation in mortgage-based securities. The second thing they get going, particularly starting from the time that President Clinton was inaugurated, was the unleashing of a wave of money, a wall of money, fictitious money, for essentially the so-called computer technology Information Society program. Now, as you know, in the 2000, especially the summer of 2000, the spring and summer, while the election was going on and nobody was noticing reality, the bubble collapsed, the Y2K bubble. The wall of money poured into you could get money from various sources for nothing, for less than nothing. We had a case out here outside in Virginia called Windstar. And money was being poured into this thing, which never produced anything. Executives were being taken on, given large salaries. The place never produced anything. And in that course, it went belly up. And the people fled into who knows where, into various places. They took their insanity and ran. But this was typical. So as of 2000, while Al Gore was running, who knows, he's always running. He should see his doctor. During this period, the system changed. And in came George Bush, the George Bush administration, and George didn't know what was going on. He was simply a stooge for Cheney. And new measures were put in, especially what they planned was to go to war. And the decision to go to war was not made after 9/11. It was made at the beginning. And some of you may recall that I forecast publicly that we could expect something like what Goering had done, Hermann Goering, in February of 1933, where Hitler had been announced as chancellor and everybody was laughing, saying, this jerk's going to be out of there quick. But then what Goering did, he set fire to the Reichstag, the Parliament building of Germany. And on the same night of that, the same guy who's behind some of the Federalist Society people here put through promulgated a law, under which Hitler was given dictatorial powers. And he retained and increased those dictatorial powers from February of 1933 until the time he died. And you know what happened to the world after that as a result. So this is the kind of thing that happened, which we call 9/11 and similar kinds of things. That the new administration coming in, that administration was just created artificially out of mud or something worse, less pleasant circumstances, by George Shultz, the guy who led in putting the Nazi regime of Pinochet into power in Chile, and under whose direction from Chile, the southern cone, Operation Condor, which was a Nazi-like mass murder of people, was conducted. And this kind of government under Shultz, who represented that in our history, together with Felix Rohatyn, who was also a Nazi type, a Nazi banker type, pushed through policies which were dictatorial policies. And on the evening of September 11th, 2001, the attempt was made to push through actual dictatorial powers. They didn't succeed in going all the way. They got quasi-dictatorial powers in the hands of Cheney and Company. And that has been the history of the United States from that time to the present time. Now, Cheney is not that important in some respects. He's only a thug. He's a broken-down relic of a failed football team, who has the weight but not the brains to go with that qualification. He was once a lineman for the telephone company. They wouldn't let him climb anything because he might fall or break something. So he's not really a great talent. He's actually owned by his wife, who keeps him as a sort of a mascot, ties him up outside at night, except on two occasions where he helped give birth to daughters. This guy is not a brain. He's a bully. He's a mafia collection agent. That's what he is. But he works for groups of bankers and others associated with George Shultz. And George Shultz is not just a figure of the U.S. He's an international figure. And the center of power lies not in the United States. It lies in London, of which Al Gore is virtually a citizen these days. At least he's a British agent. He's officially an agent of the British government and of the British monarchy. His titles come in part from the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles. The program that he's pushing today comes from Britain, not from the United States. This kind of thing. So a dictatorship was imposed upon the United States. Not a full dictatorship, but what has acted pretty much like one. And we have a whole generation, the baby boomer generation, of people who, especially who were born between 1945 and 1956 actually. A specific generation which was brainwashed in a very specific way. That's the white-collar generation, not the blue-collar generation. The blue-collar generation of that those period was not the same as the white-collar generation. The white-collar generation are, we are the wonderful. Children born then, being told we are wonderful, unlike the blue-collar types. We are wonderful. We're going onward and upward. We're going to be the power. This was the period of the white-collar myth, the period of the organization man, and the organization men working with the corporations, largely military-related corporations. We're going to run the world. And then, 1957, February 1957, we had the deep recession, which continued into 1961. And that was the end of the power of the baby boomer generation. But the little kiddies, born between 1946 and 1956, of that generation, were embedded from their families with a certain ideology, which became known as the 68er generation, the 68er ideology. These kiddies, who hated blue-collar people, they hated factory workers, they hated farmers, they hated engineering, they hated science, and were determined to create a paradise in which none of these things existed. And over the period, as my generation began to die out in the 1980s, in particular, toward the end of the 80s, they took away, they shut down the industries with their influence. They did insane things to stop technological progress. They destroyed our farmers. They ruined our industries. They bankrupted our working people from industry. They ruined everything. And they called themselves the Golden Generation. And therefore, this revolution of the 68ers, which was actually a product of this phenomenon in the post-war period of people who hated Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and wanted to destroy everything in the United States that represented Franklin Roosevelt. They couldn't do it all at once. But after the Kennedy assassination and the launching of the war in Indochina, they were able, step by step, to do that. And using, especially as the 68ers typify this, use the generation which had come to adulthood, the generation born from 1946 to 1956. Use that generation as a ramrod, as on the streets of the United States and elsewhere, during the spring, summer, and autumn of 1968, to unleash a cultural revolution, which was the secret of destroying the United States. What did they do, the 68ers? The 68ers, first of all, started with class instinct against the working people and farmers and scientists of the United States, the ones who were hated by the 68ers on the street. And with this, they divided the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party had been based on farmers and working people and ideas of that type. The 68ers were against it in the name of the left. But the left was really the right. The children of the same people who created Hitler in Germany back in the 1920s and 1930s. So they divided the Democratic Party. You brought a potentially fascist movement in to a Democratic president, a Republican president, Clinton, to Nixon. And Nixon was not the problem. Nixon was an instrument of conveying the problem. He was not the disease, he was the carrier of the disease. And he didn't even know what the disease was. This is a product of what was called by Eisenhower, the military-industrial complex. That combination, which had taken over the country with the aid of the baby boomers, with the aid of the 68ers, who had destroyed the opposition, an opposition which was not exclusively tied to the Democratic Party, but the hardcore of it was in the Democratic Party, and it was in the Franklin Roosevelt tradition, as Kennedy affirmed that when he was president. That was destroyed. Since that time, if you belong to the lower 80% of family income brackets in the United States, you and the conditions of life upon which your traditions are dependent has been systematically destroyed. The attempt to destroy Social Security, the actual success in destroying the healthcare system, and so forth and so on, are products of this process. We have what is, in effect, a fascist regime in the United States today, which is called the Bush government. And you have a revolt against this coming up from within the generation of young people between 18 and 35, young adults between 18 and 35. There's where the revolt is. There's where the instinct is there. Because the baby boomer generation, that is the white-collar generation, not the people of the blue-collar 68ers, not the farmers, not the poorer people, but those who represent the white-collar culture of the baby boomer generation, which was built up by brainwashing of children during the period 1946 through 1956. And that out of that has come now a destruction of the United States and a fascist system. But what we have is we have now a generation of young people, young adults, between 18 and 35. As we saw this past week in California, we had a situation around the issue of the impeachment of Dick Cheney. Throughout this country, up in a recent period, you've had a mobilization, since the Democratic Party took over the Congress, a mobilization to block any attempt to impeach Cheney, saying we'll do it when we get into power by the next election in 2008. We'll get into power in January 2009, and then we'll eliminate the problems. They'll never get that far. They won't have a government by January 2000, the way things are going now. So this is a change. So this is where the problem lies. Now, therefore, if the United States is going to survive, and if the world, in fact, is going to survive, we're going to have to get rid of this problem. We now have to make a choice. It's not a matter of a choice. You can choose to go one of two ways. You can't choose. You choose one way or you go the other way. You either choose to eliminate Cheney and what he represents, or you go the other way. Look, Ma, no United States. Look, people who are looking at the United States, no world. Because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world still, despite its problems. If the dollar were to collapse, you would have a chaotic chain reaction globally, a collapse of trade, a collapse of financial values, which would mean the whole world would go into not a depression, but a financial and economic new dark age, comparable to what happened in the middle of the 14th century then. So therefore, we have to do something immediately to prevent the collapse which is oncoming, which, if it came now, would be a new dark age. Because the key to this is you must save the role of the United States as a reserve currency, the United States dollar. Otherwise, the whole shebang goes down under. Now, there are many people in high positions who don't agree with that. They say they have an idea for a system to replace the U.S. and the U.S. dollar, which was their intention. This idea, as by this fellow Ben Steele of the Council of Foreign Relations, the guy's an idiot, but he's an informed idiot. He's an idiot because he's trying to save the system which he likes. The system which he likes cannot be saved. The system of institutions like the Council of Foreign Relations proposes could never work. They're finished. But they believe. They believe. They believe that this is the way the world must be. They believe in paradise, even if it's hell. As long as they manage it. Or at least have a franchise. But it won't work. What this guy does that writes in Foreign Affairs is a piece of idiocy. It's a piece of criminal idiocy. It's national suicide. It's world suicide. He proposes that three special privately controlled currencies run the world. What about the dollar? Every value in the world today, internationally, is premised on the role of determining role of the dollar and obligations of the dollar as a reserve currency. For example, if the dollar collapses, what happens to the assets of China? Boom. If the dollar collapses, what happens to the assets of India? Boom. If the dollar collapses, what happens to Europe? Boom. What happens to the United States and every other part of the world? It goes down. Because under this system, without a stable currency, without a standard of value in commerce, you cannot maintain the system. And you can't maintain the system if you begin to shut down the factories and the other facilities as a result of a financial breakdown. You have something worse than a depression. You have a dark age. Therefore, if you don't save the role of the dollar as a reserve currency, as a standard of value, monetary value, then the monetary system itself cannot be sustained. However, these guys, like this guy from the Foreign Affairs, wants to eliminate the dollar, wants to eliminate the United States. He's not a patriot. He wants to eliminate the United States. He says so. You read it carefully. Read the intention. What's he proposing to do? That's his intention. His intention is to destroy the United States. By destroying, particularly, the reserve role of the U.S. dollar. Whereas if you look at the obligations spelled out in dollar worldwide, as to China, as to India, as to Europe, as to elsewhere, the entire system goes under. It's a dollar system. You can pretend it isn't. You can talk about going to other combinations of currencies, blocks of currencies. It won't work. Because the whole world together is held together today by the debt of the United States. And therefore, if you cannot defend the position of the United States as a debtor nation, the world as a whole now will go under. So therefore, you have these crazy ideas, like this Steele from the Council of Foreign Relations. Well, why do you express these ideas? Not because he knows what he's doing, but because he's grasping at straws. He's trying to say, we're going to sink the dollar. That's good. We need a new currency. He's panning. He's like the eunuch panning for a sexual relationship. There's nothing else to dream about. But if people believe him and believe people like him, then we all go to hell for a couple of generations. And the population of this planet will go from over, in terms of billions, will go over 6.5 to less than 1 in a very short period of time. Whole languages will disappear. Whole sections of culture will vanish. It was that kind of dark age. As Gore has already proposed to wipe out the population of Africa with his program. That would happen. So therefore, defending the dollar as a reserve currency is necessary for every sane nation and every informed and sane part of the world population. The system is bankrupt. What we have to do is declare bankruptcy and put the international financial system into receivership, where governments hold and decide what to do about the bankrupt monetary financial system. And take action to ensure that what must be paid, what must be active, what must continue, will continue. Pensions will continue to be paid. Investments in productive enterprise will be made. Payments on whole categories of outstanding obligations will be suspended or canceled. For example, all gambling debts should be canceled immediately by the action of a monetary reform, because there's no investment. Gambling debt doesn't represent wealth. So cancel the gambling debts. And they're the biggest part of the debt of the world right now, is gambling debts, one form or the other. And then take measures through the use of power of governments to come to trading agreements and credit agreements, which not only maintain the level of pleasant physical activity, but actually increase it. Now, there are several things that have to be done. First of all, we have to reverse the destruction of the economy of the United States, which has gone on especially since 1971. We have destroyed industries. We are a post-industrial society. We depend upon the production of other parts of the world. We do not earn our own living. We go into hawk to buy the things we don't produce. And we have nothing to show with which to pay for the things we buy. And the margin is debt. Our health care is vanishing. Our factories are going. Our farmers are being bankrupted. Farming has been transformed from a source of food into a source of ethanol. And other foolish things of this type. So therefore, the government must take charge in the same way and under the same authority, the same constitutional authority that Franklin Roosevelt used during the 1930s. The job is bigger than what Roosevelt faced, admittedly. But the same principles will work. There are constitutional principles. They're not some wild innovation in law. They're going back to the principles of the American system as Roosevelt understood it and succeeded in taking a bankrupt nation, the United States, in the 1930s and transforming it within a decade into the most powerful, productive power the world had ever known. A productive power that saved the world from Nazism, that saved the world from the consequences of that, that created the possibility at the time of Roosevelt's death to bring free the world of colonialism and to establish a federation of nations, of respectively sovereign nation states, to cooperate in the development of the entire world in an equitable fashion, to end misery and to bring justice. That was stopped. Truman stopped that immediately at the end of the war. Truman immediately turned to support of recolonization, of the recolonization of Indochina, the military force recolonization of Indonesia, phony forms of freedom in Africa, a phony arrangement which is still chaotic in India, and so forth. The United States supported the British, especially the British, in recolonization of areas that have been struggling for freedom and were on the verge of getting it. Prevented development in regions of the world that wanted freedom and development and could have had it had Roosevelt lived. So go back to that. Go back to what made us the great power which at the time of Roosevelt's death could have fulfilled the promises of the Roosevelt administration. But the other guys took power on Roosevelt's death. The only solution we have today is to go back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's work, pick up the staff again, and resume what should not have been stopped. And what you find is intelligent nations around the world recognize this. Some are not so powerful, but some are relatively powerful. China has today 1.4 billion people, population, the largest part of the world population. India has over 1 billion people. You have a similar pattern of population, not as big, but the same pattern in much of Asia. Russia is still a powerful nation with great potential. And it's a Eurasian nation. That is, it's a combination from its history of a nation with ties to Europe and ties into Asia. It's the bridge between European civilization and Asian culture. If you unite these nations, including the United States, with a determination to save this world from hell. If you have Russia, China, India agree on immediate negotiation of special agreements to stabilize the situation and to create the foundations of a new development in world affairs, it can work, because other nations, weaker nations, relatively speaking, will join if offered the opportunity to participate in this. And it will join it largely through what Roosevelt intended the United Nations should do, as a body not of globalization, but a body of bringing respectively sovereign nation states together in cooperation for their common interests of humanity. So it's perfectly feasible. And we've reached the point that there is no other sane choice. Now, in California this past week, we had a demonstration in a relatively small but indicative form, which shows how close we are to the possibility of doing that. We had, as a result of a number of things, the leaders of the Democratic Party had committed themselves not to impeach Cheney. Well, a lot of them are getting money from George Shultz's control circles, financial circles. A lot of the leading candidates are getting their money, directly or indirectly, from George Shultz's circles, Democrat or Republican. As it goes, Felix Rahatan, who's one of the money bags of the Democratic Party and who's a fascist. He was one of the guys who financed the Pinochet takeover of Chile. He's a real fascist. There are others of the same character. Soros is a different type, but he's also in a similar position. But then you have the bankers who are mainly directly behind George Shultz as their American point of reference. So the Democratic Party, which is looking at the things in the small, the older guys, said, don't impeach Cheney. George Shultz doesn't want us to impeach Cheney. Just go ahead and try to win the next election if you can. If you survive to do it. But the young people and the poorer people of the country don't agree. The poorer and younger people of the nation, the United States, don't agree with this policy which was taking over the leadership of the Democratic Party. The word was out, no Cheney impeachment. I said no. Well, but there happen to be a lot of people out there who want a Cheney impeachment. The impeachment of Cheney is one of the most popular projects in the world right now. Everybody wants to get rid of Cheney. So what's the problem, buddy? The guy's a criminal. He committed the crime. We got him red-handed. He lied. He got us into a war by lying, together with Tony Blair of London, who lied. And the president, who would have lied if he'd been intelligent enough to know it was a lie. What's the problem? He's done everything, every treasonous act in creation. What are you waiting for? Well, the word is out, don't bother with Cheney. We decided, don't go with Cheney. But many of the people in this country didn't agree. The impeachment of Cheney is more popular than ice cream. Some people don't like ice cream because they think it's fattening. That's a different sense. But the problem was, the people of this nation, especially the lower 80% of family income brackets, do not believe anymore that they have any independent power. They're only permitted to go out and vote for approved candidates or approved issues. They're not permitted to say, hey, wait a minute, come on, I got a different idea. They're not permitted to say that. Or they can say it, they can be called a kook. The press won't tell it, won't report it. So the people, the majority of people, the so-called will of the people, where is it? What's that, a death testament? Or a real will, a living will? No, the people were not represented. The people don't simply go out and scream. and say, we want this, and the loudest voice wins. The people have to have a system of representation through which deliberation of ideas and issues can occur, in which their voice is heard, in which their mind is engaged, in which their opinions are considered. We don't have that in the United States today. We have people who run the country and people who say to the others, okay, you guys can keep stay in your place. Do as we tell you. Listen to us. We're the wise guys. We don't have to explain it to you now. We'll tell you later. We'll tell you in January of 2009 what this election is about. So, therefore, we needed a catalyst. And our job was to be the catalyst. So we had people coming into the convention, the Democratic Party convention in California, as around the country, as in Vermont, as at elsewhere, as in Louisiana, other parts of the country, probably 100 locations this past week, saying impeach Cheney. Why wouldn't the Democratic Party do it? When the majority of the Democrats want it and know rightly that this is what must be done. Now, why didn't it occur? Well, wheeling dealing, go along to get along. So you need to, even so, if the majority wanted, how are you going to get a way in which to get the majority to have their will expressed and respected? What we did is we were the catalyst, especially our youth movement inside the Democratic Party, which triggered the process by which the desire of the majority of the people, as represented there, could be expressed. And the people were like a dam, like water on a dam. And you puncture and open a little bit in the dam, and the water comes flushing out and it takes over the landscape. Huh? So once we took the step, which breached a hole in the dam that was jamming up the works, the Democratic Party, okay, the impeached Cheney is back on the table in California and elsewhere. And that's how the will of the people is properly expressed. And that's what the role of leadership is in society. It's to know what has to be done. And to recognize this is the problem. That the old guys who were in power, particularly the veterans of the 68er phenomenon, people between today between 50 and 65 years of age, are controlling most of the positions of power in the United States as a social phenomenon. The majority of the people below 60 years of age, especially the large majority which is emerging in the 18 to 35 year age group, has no efficient representation in the United States. Therefore, talk about democracy, buddy, we mean it. Real democracy, not voted yes or no, but participate in the process of deliberation by which policy is made and adopted. The right to vote is not freedom. The right to participate in the process of deliberation by which the issues are defined, that's freedom. The right to develop and to know and have the capability of making those kinds of contributions, that's freedom. The way to have freedom is to give freedom the right to express itself. And right now, the test of freedom is the impeachment of Cheney. If you get rid of what is jamming up the works at the top in Washington, something which is crumbling, the Bush administration is disintegrating before your eyes. But you don't know whether it's the head of the going or something else, but something is going there. It's disintegrating. You're now in a situation where under conditions of crisis, if you have the mobilization, and if you are engaged with and respected by the majority of the people, if you open the gates of deliberation to participation by the people of the United States, especially the lower 80% of the family income brackets, you can, as we demonstrated in California, you can open the dam and the waters will flood forth and the changes that must be made can be made suddenly. And those things, those nightmares which besiege us today, can be washed away in the process. Now, then you come back to practicality. What is the only solution for the immediate threat of a plunge into a dark age during the year 2007, perhaps is on your summer vacation, which may be permanent this year. What can be done to solve this problem? Well, the first thing is we have to do is we have to stabilize the international monetary system. How do you do it? You get a group of powerful countries together to initiate a motion which puts the whole world financial system into receivership for control by actions of governments. Essentially what Franklin Roosevelt did during the 1930s. Put the bankers into hawk, under the control of governments, and regulate the system, and get some justice back in the system. At the same time, to recognize what must be done to rebuild the shattered economy of the world. How to get back to becoming a productive society based on scientific progress, on industry, on agriculture, development of infrastructure, the development of skills, security, an improved standard of physical standard of living for the world. How do we do that? Well, we can do it. There are things which must be done and can be done now, things not which are known. For example, let's take the case of nuclear power. Nuclear fission power is on the rise. It's unstoppable, unless we go to a dark age. Even the right-wingers of the world, generally, who are not absolutely nuts, are for nuclear fission power. If you look at the pattern of the increase of contracts and intentions for nuclear fission power development around the world, it's enormous. If you consider the issue of fresh water supplies, which are now in jeopardy in many parts of the world, which you cannot have by any means except by assistance of nuclear fission power. If you do not realize the importance of going to thermonuclear fusion as a technology, you can't solve many of the raw materials problems of the world. With thermonuclear fusion as a technology, we can solve many problems of chemistry, which we otherwise cannot solve economically. So therefore, if we take these missions of developing infrastructure, dealing with the international freshwater crisis, dealing with other things of that type, which we know how to fix by traditionally, and for which technologies which are appropriate exist and are known, we can save this planet. Not by some miracle bestowed from above, but by our own will, by adopting those measures and institutional provisions which will enable us to do it. Therefore, our job is, as in California this past week, knowing that there's a bomb ready to explode out there. The bomb is public opinion of the lower 80% of the family income brackets of the U.S. population, and similarly in other parts of the world. If you unleash the ability of this lower 80%, what Franklin Roosevelt called the forgotten man, unleash that. Let it participate in the process. Not just vote up or down, participate in the discussion. And understand that their voice in the discussion is considered important. It's a part of the process of deliberation. They're part of the process of deliberation. That's what the consent of the people means. Participation in the process of deliberation. Having the facts available. Having the discussion back and forth occur. So that when the decision is made, they participated. Whether they agreed or not, they participated. And their voice was heard. Their interests were respected. Under those conditions, we can solve. Now what we have is China has a major problem. China is actually wealthy in one respect, but it's poor, becoming poorer all the time in other respects. You have Communist Party billionaires in Russia, because the Communist Party, when they adapted to capitalism, decided that some of their party figures should be the big capitalists. So they got the Communist Party billionaires. But you also have a vast underdevelopment in China of the people of China. And China knows that they have to shift and deal with this problem. You have India. The poor of India are poorer than ever before. Maybe at the upper 20% may be somewhat much better off, but the lower 80% is not. Congress Party of India is disintegrating because it has lost its contact with the people it still had under Indira Gandhi. And is fragmenting into many parties. But India knows it needs to have a change, that the 80% of the poor in India must have some justice, which means fresh water, means all kinds of things like that. And we need a system, a world system, which provides that. Most of the nations of Asia, the people, the governments know that. They want that. They want a solution. So therefore, when you get some of the bigger powers like Russia, which is a very significant power, because it's a Eurasian power with important technologies, united with India and China, as is happening today, all you have to do is to engage the United States as a partner with these three nations and with other nations to create the bloc which can change the world. And we can do it overnight. Russia has stated its willingness to do that. The president of Russia and leading circles around it. We can have that agreement tomorrow if we have the right government in Washington. It's on the table. It's available to us now. And the American people, if they knew what it was, would want it. Our job is to make sure they know it exists. The people of China, the government of China, different policies, different views, but nonetheless, understand this need. Cooperation among the United States, Russia, China, and India. Every intelligent patriot of those countries knows that and agrees on that. They may not agree on other things, but they agree on that. They agree that with this kind of agreement, the world goes not to a period away from war and back to diplomacy. Because that combination of power in the world forces control over warfare and forces the issue back to diplomacy. And every nation in the world is sane, wants diplomacy rather than warfare. The problem is the British and the United States government presently don't want peace. They don't want diplomacy. They want warfare. And that's what we've seen since the year 2000. So therefore, we have a wonderful opportunity before us, an opportunity created by necessity. We have an option before us. It's the only option that exists. The question is, are we sane enough to take it? Are there enough people in the United States who are sane enough to support it? Can we break through the barriers in the institutions at the top today to unleash the implicit will for deliberation among the people of the United States, among particularly the 80%? As in all history, revolutions are made, and not just bloody revolutions, but all kinds of revolutions, are made by the generation of young adults between 18 and 25 years of age. A generation which continues to perform that function up to the age of about 35. That's the generation we sent to war, isn't it? It's a generation that fights every war, isn't it? It's a generation which produces the young leaders who succeed the leaders in power in time. It's a generation which absorbs new ideas and transmits them to succeeding generations. It's a generation which introduces the reforms which make society proceed from one generation to the other. You know, every important project in the world, it tends to be a long-term investment. And long-term investments have lifetimes of 25 to 50 years. And it's the younger generation which has a perspective of a 50-year investment, or at least a 25-year investment, in changing the conditions of life within their nation. That is the generation which has the spark and the commitment and the dedication to seeing through, to make it happen. And the older generation rejoices in what these younger people are doing, because that is the meaning of their lives. The meaning of the life of the older person who is not a baby boomer, but of that age, is to have a generation coming after them which is going to give meaning to what they have done and what they have been. The baby boomer generation, the white collar section of the baby boomer generation, lost that. They don't believe in their own children. They don't believe in their own ancestors. They believe that they are something perfect. They are the golden generation. like that of Athens, which destroyed Greece, so Greece has never come back from what it was then to the present day. And this was done by the golden generation, which plunged Greece into the Peloponnesian War. We have today a golden generation, which has been the instrument, not the cause, but the instrument by which the United States has been plunged into wars. The war in Vietnam, the wars in Southwest Asia, and the prospective wars which are looming today. So we need to replace the idea of the golden generation with the idea of immortality of the human being, whose mortality is connected to become immortality with preceding and ensuing generations. And if we come to this point of crisis and realize that's where we are today, as this financial system and everything around it is about to collapse, then we have one shot, one chance to avoid a dark age. And the chance is now. And the step that will make the difference is the United States government to respond to what Russia has proffered and other nations have proffered, China and India, to enter into forms of treaty agreement, long-term treaty agreement, under which we address this problem of our world, bring other nations into partnership with that agreement, and do essentially what should be obvious, to get back to a tradition, which in our country most recently was the Franklin Roosevelt tradition. Get back to the tradition which we had once, and cooperate with other nations on that basis, and all these problems can be solved. And therefore, as I've said today, what has to be done is we have to get a new Washington before 2009. The step is to get rid of Cheney, put him in a pasture, or maybe a swamp, if that's what he prefers. Yeah? Change the government in a constitutional way, react to the emergency with the emergency measures which are appropriate, and recognize the crucial thing is the financial system, including the U.S. financial system, the monetary system, is going bust right now. So therefore, let's do what's obvious. Let the governments agree to freeze, to put the banking system, the financial system, into receivership for reorganization, a process of reorganization which will save the matter of national and international credit, will permit us to launch the large-scale projects to reverse the present tendency for decay, and to share with other nations the joy of participation in common interests in development, which means security for us all and for generations to come. Thank you.
Today, someone who actually clearly understands something about Lynn and about the way that Lynn functions made a comment describing the actions of the LaRouche movement and of Lynn in particular. And it's a very apt metaphor. What he said is, he said, you know, some people who are involved in the game of politics spend their entire lives trying to move mountains. He said, your boss is a little bit different. He said, he's a realist. So he looks at a mountain and he says, I can't move that damn mountain. He said, and he turns around and instead he moves the earth under the mountain. I thought that was pretty good. I like that. I have a number of questions. Many of them are questions that have come in from people here in Washington. For those of you who are here who have questions, as always, you can submit your questions. Either you can ask those questions yourself, or you can write out your question, and I will read the question from here. In any case, please indicate your name, where you're from, and even if you'd like to ask the question yourself, please do indicate the nature of your question. For those of you who are listening over the World Wide Web, if you submit your questions via email, I will try to get to them during the course of the event. The first question, Lynn, is on the question of recent events in Russia, and it comes from someone who was recently over there. He says, Lynn, many people in policymaking positions have, I think, misunderstood recent developments in Russia as being explicitly anti-American, when in fact, my experience is that they are anything but that. It is true that Mr. Putin, in his address to his nation, delivered a clear message to those who have taken hostile action against the interests of Russia. But it seems to me that he also left the door wide open for collaboration between our two nations on many common interests, some of which you addressed in your remarks. Even in his declaration that Russia would no longer abide by the CSCE agreement when the U.S. chooses not to, he also said that Russia was willing to consider a new approach to disarmament that both countries might find more relevant to the current world situation. I'm concerned about the perception of what Mr. Putin is doing, and I'm also concerned because clearly there are individuals and institutions in the United States who are taking actions which, by any measurement, can be deemed to be hostile to the Russian nation. I'd like you to comment on this and also to comment on who it is who is taking those hostile actions and why.
The United States achieved its freedom in a struggle which began as a struggle in 1763, when a new policy of government emerged in England. This change occurred in February of 1763, in what was called the Peace of Paris. Now, the Peace of Paris was the result of an effort orchestrated by a group centered in the British East India Company of what was known as the Seven Years' War. And the Seven Years' War was a consequence of an earlier war, which is organized out of England, largely, and Netherlands, against the French government, against the French monarchy, through the complicity of a pig who was called Louis XIV, Louis XIV, who qualified as a pig. The way his bowel habits in the palace were an example of this, in the Versailles Palace, where he had no place to defecate, and he would do it in public in front of his admiring subjects. This is, shows very bad taste. Anyway, so what happened is the British had played a game of the Anglo-Dutch liberal faction, which is associated with the Anglo-Dutch East India Company, had played a game of winning wars the way Persia won a war against Athens, by getting Athens to destroy itself in the Peloponnesian War. The way Britain has repeatedly won wars against Europe and to some degree the United States, by getting the Europeans to fight wars against themselves. The Seven Years' War, for example, was set up by Britain to get everybody in Europe on the continent conducting a war against Prussia, Frederick the Great's Prussia. So the British helped finance Prussia in defending itself against wars against it by France, Russia, Austria-Hungary, and so forth. And since the Frederick of Prussia was not exactly incompetent, these were, he came out fairly well in the process. But the Seven Years' War was this type, that the powers of Europe destroyed themselves by mutual warfare, orchestrated by the British, in which the British participated to some degree. They took over India, they took over Canada and some other places, and established their superiority in naval power. So therefore, they won the war. The British had won the war, which they had won partly with support from the Americans in North America. They turned against the people of what became the United States with repressive measures to shut down technology, shut down industry, shut down large part sectors of agriculture, and so forth. So they established an empire, not the empire of the British monarchy, but the empire of the British Anglo-Dutch East India Company. The same thing happened later in the Napoleonic Wars. France had been an ally of the United States in the American Revolution. A number of other countries in Europe had been sympathizers and partners of the United States in launching of the American Revolution and its successes. How did the British play that? Well, first of all, the British controlled a Freemasonic faction in France and elsewhere called the Martinist Freemasonry. And so they orchestrated from London, out of what had been created in 1782 as the British Foreign Office, they had cut up a secret committee, which is like the Dirty Tricks Department of the British Foreign Office, headed by our dear friend, who then directed the French Revolution. The Duke of Orleans was a British agent. Jacques, his banker friend, was a British agent. Necker was a British agent. The Siege of Bastille was done, orchestrated by Philippe on behalf of the candidacy for Prime Minister of France of Necker. The French Revolution was orchestrated by people like Danton and Marat, who were agents run out of London, trained in London and run out of London and deployed into France as terrorist agents. The Robespierre faction was largely controlled by the same Freemasonic operation. Napoleon Bonaparte, who had been an agent of Maximilian Robespierre, was picked by the Freemasonic masonry, the Martinist Freemasonry, and given a new personality, modeled upon the Grand Inquisitor of Spain. And Napoleon then, with a new personality, became the warfare agent who despoiled all of continental Europe in Napoleonic Wars, which were not wars in the sense of ordinary war. They were looting wars. Napoleon and his forces were out stealing. They was trying to steal every place. The British played this, as typified by the Spanish War, which was a British trap for Napoleon. So what happened is the character of Europe was changed by the British orchestration of wars in Europe, a model which is the cult Persian model, used to induce, through the cult of Delphi, used to induce Athens through sophistry to destroy itself in the Peloponnesian War. And Athens never came back as a result of that war. What has been done to the United States in the Indochina War of the 1960s, what is being done in Southwest Asia today, is the same thing. The British, because it was the Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, who led in defining the lies used by Cheney and others, and he's practically an agent, Cheney's practically an agent of Tony Blair, or the people who own Tony Blair, to get the United States into the Southwest Asia War, which he had no business having, and keeping us there, orchestrated from London. The intent has been, in the same time, to destroy the United States economy. And we have been destroyed. We've destroyed at the greatest rate under Bush. Our industries are gone. We lost our automobile industry, which is the heart of our industry. We are losing our agriculture to ethanol. We're losing everything. We're an impoverished nation. all for the greater glory of Britain. And along comes this creep from the Council of Foreign Relations and proposes this new thing, destroy the United States. To uproot from this planet anything that smells like Franklin Roosevelt or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. That's the point. Now, so when you're looking at this problem, that's what you have to understand. And we as Americans have to become patriotic again, not butt kisses for the British. We've got too many of those guys. When you're kissing a British butt, it's hard to see the world around you. And that's what the problem is. The British are determined to induce us to destroy ourselves. That's not every Brit, but the relevant circles, the financier circles. And therefore, what do they intend us to do? They intend to create a state of war with the United States on one side and Russia, China, and India on the other. And also at the same time playing China, India, and Russia against each other. So Russia, which is aware of this, but some people in Iran were not, and they played some mistaken games as a result of that, says, all right, we have no issue with the United States, no existential issue with the United States as such. Why don't we cooperate with them? Cheney has said since the beginning he was president of Russia, has said that repeatedly. It is Russia's policy to enter into cooperation with the United States for the purpose of dealing with this world situation, to end the danger of general warfare by establishing agreement on common interests of respectively sovereign nation states, no globalization, common interests among respectively sovereign nation states. No shoving anything down somebody's throat. And to find those issues on which our interests coincide or are complementary, and thus to establish long-term agreements, which means 25 to 50-year agreements, largely centered on economic programs, investment in common economic programs or mutual economic programs, to help the other nations through cooperation in developing equitable agreements, and therefore to tie the economic and other interests of the respective nations so much into one another that they will not lightly start picking fights with each other because they have a strong common interest in not having the fight. And therefore, they will resort to other methods to solve their differences rather than warfare. That's what every intelligent person who understands history in the world understands today. We have passed the time where we have to consider warfare as a desirable instrument of policy for creating power over other nations or other peoples. That idea has to go permanently. Wars to defend yourselves against an attack, to defend yourself against some predator, that's one thing. But no wars for the purpose of an extension of interest in gaining power or maintaining power. Every intelligent statesman of the world understands that. What we have is we have the British interest understands that. And they understand that. Now, I'll explain what the British interest is, because that has to be understood too. They understand that because the British interest is in maintaining an empire. And you cannot maintain an empire, and their empire is not an old type of empire. It's a financial empire. It's a financier empire. Not a flag empire. To control the world's monetary financial system. To have systems of bankers who are like suckers, predators, are out there sucking the blood of nations. And to maintain the rot out of the blood suckers to suck blood. That's the British Empire. And if you have sovereign nation states, which are powerful as groups of states, and they can say, you can't suck our blood, the British Empire is dead. If you say we have to have a financial monetary system, which is equitable in terms of the interests of nations, the British Empire is dead. So therefore, it's the British Empire, which is actually the Anglo-Dutch liberal empire, which includes Felix Rahaten, which includes George Shultz, and so forth as agents of this treasonous creature, that is the enemy. The world, insofar as nation states are aware of the importance of sovereignty and the importance of peaceful cooperation among the nations, is the opposition to that. But by playing nations against each other, as the British played in the Seven Years' War, or the Napoleonic Wars, or otherwise, they play one nation against the other and thereby undermine and destroy national sovereignty and the perception of national sovereignty by these mutual warfare. Therefore, warfare of that form is the enemy of civilization. And those of us who understand that we must force the issue of intelligent cooperation of the type among sovereign nation states. So, therefore, if you don't understand the British are the enemy, you have a great deal of difficulty in understanding what the problem is. And if you think the British are our allies against some other country, you're a damn fool. Sometimes the British will come up with an idea which is a good idea and it's worth supporting. Okay, on that basis, we'll deal with it. But on the idea of preserving a financier type of Venetian-style empire, like that which is of the period of the Crusades, which is what the British Empire is, that we don't tolerate. And therefore, that's where the problem lies. The problem is the Anglefield. Do you realize how much Anglefield sentimentality there is in the United States, especially among the upper 20% of family income brackets? What soft-headed suckers for a British line they are. They like everything British, or brutish, as the case may be. So that's where the problem lies. And the answer to that is to simply to proceed to make clear, as I am attempting to make clear today, and by other means, what the interest of the United States is now. And let's fight for our interest as a nation and find partners which desire to cooperate with us in fulfilling that interest, which is also their interest. And I tell you, if you have 1.4 billion Chinese, over a billion Indians, a lot of other Asian countries' populations, sane people in Europe, the forces in South and Central America which are tied to us, and the people of the United States agreed on this, I think we can win that. And I think we can rally people to support one another against this British plot. Yeah. But if you don't do that, if you're soft on the British, you don't have a single chance at doing that. I have real British relatives, you know, I have lots of them. But the best of them came over here.
Okay. Next question is on a slightly different topic. It says, Lynn, your movement really put itself on the map in the 1980s when thousands of ordinary citizens sought office as LaRouche Democrats. This past weekend, as I learned from the website, two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, who I'd like to say represent a layer of young people who are anything but ordinary, sought and won positions in the California State Democratic Party, which is by far the largest Democratic organization in the U.S. I'm wondering if this means that you are about to revisit the tactic of the 80s, but this time with a bit of a twist. My own political instincts, which are still worth a few bucks in this town, tell me that running a large number of qualified young people for public office might be the single most effective intervention that anybody can make in the upcoming Democratic presidential campaign. That's my two cents, and I'd like to know what you think about it.
Well, the key to this is we have campaigns which depend too much on money. That money buys campaigns rather than campaigns being financing people who are working at them. We're running a show type of campaigning, which is very expensive. You raise money from whoever you raise money from to buy advertising, mass advertising, which stinks usually, where you're advised to shape your advertising by experts so that it really won't address any issues. For example, look at each of the presidential campaigns. Look at them now. Not one of them has said anything important. That is, they've said things which touch upon issues, so-called, or perception issues. But they don't say how you're going to get it. For example, Hillary said, well, when I go into office in 2009, I'll deal with a war in Iraq. I'll pull our troops out. What's that? That's not dealing with the issue. How do you get them out now? And as some people said, how many dead do you want between now and then? And we just had the highest rate of death of U.S. troops in any month in the recent period reported. How long do you want that to go along? In a war which you cannot win, because you're looking to defeat the enemy. And sometimes somebody will turn around and say, we have met the enemy and he is ourselves. That's what this is. So therefore, we go to the financial angels, which usually are not angels, but quite the other contrary, and we ask them to contribute large sums of money as donations for campaigns. The money then goes to professionals and into advertising agencies, which specialize in this, and they run the politics. They advise, they brainwash the candidate. Here's what you have to do. Look at this constituent. Look at this one. You got to do this. You got to do this. Well, wait a minute, buddy. How about a new idea? How about a new idea that is responsive to reality? Why do you want a slogan instead of an idea? Why don't you address something? Because the campaigns are not addressed to the issues of the people. Now, if the people are involved in a campaign, as we used to have the clubhouse methods of campaigning in the United States, which is what we were doing in the 1980s, essentially, that was really clubhouse politics. It wasn't big advertising campaigns. It was clubhouse politics. Ordinary citizens of this or that talent and background were participating and running, and they were doing the campaigning. They were doing the policy work. They were relating themselves to the realities of life of the people they were addressing. And we had a great effect. Relatively, we had more result per dollar than any other campaign. So we were getting more for less. Why? Because we were doing the right thing. So, yes, you're right that the issue is mass campaigning. Here's what we've got. We've got the Democratic Party base. The great part of the traditional Democratic Party base, which is in farmers, working people, so forth, and some professionals. That part is easily accessed by us. We don't have any problem with them. We have also Republicans, who are nominal Republicans now, who share more of that view. As a matter of fact, many Republicans were once Reagan Democrats. And there's a reason for that. So we really don't have a problem there. We have people who are not in political parties, but who are politically conscious, but just withdrawn from trust in any political party or turned away from these parties because of corruption. So therefore, if you organize on the mass base and show some action on issues relevant, you can build a mass movement. For example, the Cheney issue, impeaching of Cheney, is a mass issue. You probably have one of the biggest bases of support in politics right now is for the impeachment of Cheney. If you go after the impeachment of Cheney, look at the military question. How many families have been affected in what degree by the frictional effects of not only the war in Iraq on them, but the fact is that this chintzy government we have, which spends money for all kinds of things, does not take care of its soldiers. It doesn't provide them with what they need. It doesn't take care of them when they're injured. It tries to chisel them out of any their rights as veterans to cure the things they're suffering from being soldiers. Brutalizing their families, is that a good policy? Therefore, people who understand that, who think about, hey, these guys, they thought they were working for the country. You send them over there. You lied to get them in that war. They died. You liar. You killed them with your damn lies. You sent them over there without protection. You wanted to save money because you wanted to give it to Cheney, to Cheney's friends, for Halliburton. You looted the United States to pay off Halliburton and other similar firms. We got sick. We were injured. We came back. We went to the hospital. We couldn't get care. We're veterans. We're injured. We can't get health care to deal with the problems. Our families are suffering. You send us over there. We lose money because we can't get enough to support our families. We're over there fighting these wars. We weren't trained for this kind of war. We're State Guard. We're National Guardsmen. We're reservists. We're not trained for this. You sent us over there without being trained for the job. And we got killed and our families suffered. And we lost our house. We lost this. We lost that because of you. And you say we got to be patriotic and suffer for this war, continuation of this war? Think of how many parts of the country are affected directly or indirectly by this kind of pattern. Of a war fought too long and should not have begun. Then think of all the other issues. The health care issue. The pensions issue. Think about what happened to the state of Michigan, the state of Ohio, the state of Indiana, alone, as a result of the failure of the Congress to support me on the issue of the emergency action on the auto industry. To convert part of the auto industry that isn't being used and convert it to save it for what we do need, which is infrastructure development. Rivers are all kinds of things that need the kind of high technology engineering capability that was buried in the auto industry, which is now thrown into waste on the garbage dump. And this affects the communities. It affects the people of the United States, where they live, in gut issues of their lives, personal lives. What you have to do is connect the gut issues that they feel and experience in their personal life and show them the connection to policymaking on a national world level. Then they can respond. They don't respond because they don't know how to respond. They say, what the hell are we going to do? Is there anything we can do about this? Is this just going to keep going on and on and on when we never be able to do anything about it? You've got to show them a connection. Where's the hot button? Where do you go? What's the button you push? How do you understand this stuff? What do you do to fix it? And that's the problem. So therefore, it's... Yes, you have to engage the people for two reasons. First of all, you need a popular base, otherwise you can't really win elections in an honest way. Secondly, if you don't bring people in the population in depth into fighting out these issues, they will never understand these issues. Most of our people out there don't understand what the issues are. They don't understand what the causes of these problems are. They don't know where the handle is that you can pull to fix it. When you get them involved in political campaigns on the base level and you bring grand politics on the national, international level down to the base level, then the people who are participating in the campaigns become the vehicle by which you educate the population around them. And that, to me, is real politics.
Again, for people who are listening from our live audience here in Washington or for people who are listening via the internet, we can entertain questions from all of you, but you do have to submit them. Just jot down what it is you want to ask and give it to one of the staff people, and I'll try to get to it. Lynn, we have a number of questions that were submitted on the mass shooting at Blacksburg that took place a couple of weeks ago. This question is actually from the staff director of the Congressional Women's Caucus, but I've taken some liberties with it because we've gotten a number of questions on this. She says, Mr. LaRouche, many people have responded to the tragedy at Blacksburg with calls for stronger gun laws. While I think we can all agree that individuals with a history of mental health problems should not have access to weapons, I have trouble seeing how strengthening such laws would have prevented the Blacksburg tragedy. I've seen members of your organization around town sporting signs blaming Dick Cheney, she said, which I don't quite understand. She says, I also have looked at your remarks, although I admit that I have not looked at them in depth, regarding that tragedy and video games. And I noticed that you have now called to make those video games illegal. She said, I have some thoughts on that, and I'd like your view. She said, baby boomers were the lab rats in a social experiment to examine the effects of hallucinogenic drugs when used on a broad scale. I personally believe that the entire nation is still suffering the damage of those experiments. I think that if you're actually serious about making these games illegal, you are probably in for the political fight of your life. She says, on the one hand, the sums of money involved are enormous. Second, if what you're saying is correct, there's also an explicit political agenda involved in the promotion of these games. And finally, many young people are already, if not addicted to these games, passionately committed to their right to play them. It seems to me that the only way such a campaign could succeed and the only way to wean our young people from these games is if you reach out and convince young people that, in fact, they are once again being used as lab rats by people who they would otherwise perceive as their enemies. I'm not addressing this to you as a neat trick or spin. I happen to think that it is the actual character of this, but I was wondering if you would discuss the entire question a little bit more.
You have two issues here which converge, two crucial issues of strategic policy. This is not a local social issue. It's a strategic issue. Going back into the 1970s, as a byproduct of the rush of euphoria around some of the Clinton administration, or the Reagan administration, the Nixon administration, you had the presentation, as by Huntington, in a book called The Soldier and the State, of a policy which is not original to him, but which was something he made a book about, which was already in the works. The intention was at that point a military policy, which became associated with Cheney as of 1989, when Cheney was Secretary of Defense, of this reform in military affairs, which was actually the idea, which has been in progress ever since, and Felix Rahatan is one of the big promoters of this, together with George Shultz, to get you some idea of who's behind it and why some Democrats don't like to talk about it, because they get money from George Shultz or from Felix Rahatan. So the policy was to eliminate the military of governments and to take the logistical aspect of support of military affairs and turn it over to private interests, such as Halliburton, as in Iraq. The greatest expense is not for the military as such, it's for Halliburton and similar companies, who get bonanzas at high rates and so forth for doing military jobs. But the idea was to eliminate the military as a governmental function, a traditional form of military as a governmental function, and to replace it by something like the worst phase of the Roman legions. And the Roman legions, once the Roman Empire was established, were nothing but assassination squads and extermination squads like the Nazi SS. Later. The SS-type troops. Now, there was a scientific question that came in this, already in this period. How do you condition a human being to become a stone killer who can kill and kill and kill and does not see the face of a human being as human when they shoot? As this guy down there in Plattsburgh. Well, they developed it. And the technique was originally developed for the U.S. military, for a special military training program, or for special infantry, and then was spilled out for private entertainment by youth. It was also used to train police officers. For example, you had a guy in the Bronx, came out of his house, a perfectly respectable citizen of Afro-American designation. Huh? He came out of his house, and was surrounded by cops, and they asked for some identification. He reached to his hip pocket to get his wallet, and they put 41 bullets into him. He had no weapon, and he was not guilty of anything. Now, this was a result of the kind of training that was given to police officers of a special type so that they shoot that way. They empty their gun. And one of the key weapons for this is, of course, the Glock, which has a high capacity, low magazine capacity. So you come in, as was used down here with this show. Bang, 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 and about a 50% kill ratio. Systematically. A brainwashed zombie. Now, the technique that's used was developed especially from 2000 on. In 2000, you had a crisis in the so-called tech the industry of Microsoft and so forth. They were in danger because the flood of money, the wall of money which was being poured into the Y2K project, stopped. And so all these computer companies were in trouble on their growth perspectives because the flood of money that had gone in earlier to the Y2K project was stopped. Now they suddenly discovered that these games, these killer games, were a good alternative source of profit. And the shape of the development of the computer industry technology since that time has depended increasingly upon development of computer technologies for killer games. Killer games is one of the biggest sources of income of the computer industry, the growth income of the computer industry. Which is why a democratic supporter and funder like Microsoft is one of the biggest backers in one of the most dangerous and deadly of these games. This is where the computer industry gets its money. So now you have a combination of you've trained a mass of the population as ready to go into a military to become a new kind of killer as specified in The Soldier and the State of Huntington from the 1970s. And you've got them on the street. You've got millions of young men who are trained killers, some of whom never touched a weapon. You have cases of a little boy in one case, for example. A young boy, not in his teens, who picked up a pistol for the first time and shot with deadly precision and killed. He'd never pulled the trigger before. But he'd pulled the trigger on a video game. And that's the way this thing works. This guy, Cho, yes, he did some training on target range, but his basic training and personality was destroyed as it was by a video game. And it's a Microsoft video game, chiefly. So what you, therefore the two things converge. On the one side you had the initial thrust was simply the Soldier and the State, to eliminate the regular military of soldiers with a conscience, who are the instrument of society. To produce SS-type killers of soldiers without conscience. Like the SS who killed the Jews and others in the concentration camps. Same mentality. How do you mass produce this? It's not so easy. Human beings do not like to kill human beings. Snipers do not like to be a sniper after the first time they do it. The revulsion, the reaction is strong. How do you brainwash them to becoming a zombie they can kill and kill and kill and kill without feeling? So-called mafia killer. How do you produce a mafia killer type who kills on order, never has any compunction, and likes to add a fillip to it, as you do with these games, like the cop killing game. Behead the cops after you kill them. Huh? You had a case of this just recently. three cops are killed as a result of playing that game. The guy playing that game. So, the one hand is the idea of the form of military affairs, eliminate the military, privatize the military, like the SS, the Nazi SS, and then recruit to this new kind of military by reaching out in the police training and into the civilian population generally to get young people of military age, military recruit age, and train them in the killer techniques, which means they can march from the game into the legions out there killing people in various parts of the world without any shift in gears. Now, do we think this is a crime? The promotion of this kind of operation with these intentions is itself a crime against humanity. It's a Nuremberg crime. And people should be given their Nuremberg indictment notices now who participate in doing this. And then this also tells us something about the society in which we live. It tells us a great deal about Cheney, because Cheney has been the key instrument of this. Not only Cheney, but Felix Rahatan. Felix Rahatan, from the Middlebury Monster, from Middlebury, Vermont, a center of racism, a traditional center of racism in the United States, in Vermont, and a center of fascism in Vermont. And Felix Rahatan, who was a graduate of that place, but also some other things more satanic, Felix Rahatan is the key sponsor of this program in the private sector. He's a fascist. He comes trained by the same people who were behind Hitler in Europe, from France. So this tells you that in our country we have a Nazi SS type in power. And Cheney is simply a symptom of that. George Shultz is a symptom of that. The United States putting Pinochet into power in Chile and backing the Operation Condor, Nazi-like murders in the Southern Cone, is an expression of that. So therefore we have to recognize this is not a social problem which has to be treated as a social problem, like the drug problem. This is a crime against humanity, and those who participate in the crime should be notified. This is a crime against humanity, and we have the following information about you. Do you want to quit?
Okay. The next question is from a senior Democratic staff director on the House side. Her committee is directly in a position to deal with some of these questions. And she says, Lynn, given the scale of the crisis in the mortgage and mortgage-backed securities markets and the numbers of foreclosures that we can expect, I know that you've said that no state efforts to stop foreclosures will work. I understand, though, that you have called for a moratorium on foreclosures. My question is, how exactly would this work? What would the response of the financial community to such a proposal be?
The response of the financial community is not too important. No, because we are at a point, as I've indicated today in my principal remarks earlier, that you're at the point that the financial system in its present form is finished. It has been thoroughly criminalized in many of its respects, at least morally criminalized and otherwise. And therefore, the opinion of the financial community, except for giving information which may be useful for our purposes, is no longer of much interest. We have to put the entire financial community in receivership. That means that we don't shut things down. We may shut some things down. Gambling casinos, of course, will be immediately shut down. Immediately. The gambling industry, shut down. That will help a lot. And it also helped to give a jolt to some people to stop being prostitutes. Because if you gamble, you're a prostitute. you know, somebody, a certain guy from New York may not like that, but that's Donald Trump may not like me for that. But I don't think he likes me anyway, so no loss. I would say, you're fired, Donald. No, you're fired. I would say it to you now, Donald, directly. You're fired. Your time has gone. All right, now, with what we're going to have to do, you have to do a financial reorganization. Now, what do you want to do? You don't want any instability, any social instability. That's number one. You say, okay, you're occupying a house, right? The foreclosure time has come. Whatever. You stay there. What about, well, we're going to put it all into reorganization. We're listed as one of the houses which may have some asset value in it. We're going to look at all the cases. So we're going to shut down the whole, we're going to shut down the mortgage industry, essentially, in its present form. We're also going to put the banking system into receivership. What does that mean? If we don't put it into receivership, the banks are going to go under. The banks of the United States do not control the United States. Hedge funds, which are largely based in the Cayman Islands, the British Empire's Cayman Islands, are the dominant factor in the hedge funds, and the hedge funds are the dominant factor presently in the U.S. banking system. The hedge funds virtually own the banking system, either by debt relationships or otherwise. So therefore, what we want to do is we want to keep the banks alive, because that's where the normal course of industry and so forth, and people are involved, the communities. So we're going to freeze it. What do we do? The measure we have to take is to declare the Federal Reserve System in bankruptcy, in government receivership in bankruptcy. Now, the Constitution provides the means for this. If it's bankrupt, then the authority of the U.S. government in respect to our currency and banking comes into play. So the Federal Reserve System as a system which has been mismanaged, especially by the most recent chairman, Greenspan, that thing is put in receivership because it made a mess of things. And the place is bankrupt. So therefore, if the banking system of the United States is bankrupt, then the federal government is the only agency which has the authority to deal with that. So the federal government puts the banking system into receivership. How? By putting the Federal Reserve System into receivership. Now what you do is you tell the banker you don't shoot, I mean the one that didn't commit a crime, and he's there. You say, you stay there. You say, you're going to freeze this. Everything is now under government supervision. Our concern is that things that have to immediately happen through banking will happen. That financing of this and financing of that, so forth, the credit system, that will be there. It will be guaranteed by the government. But we're managing it. We're going to reorganize it. We're going to write down eventually a lot of this debt. We're going to cancel a lot of this debt. We're going to cancel entire categories of debt, which are nothing but gambling debts. We're going to have a banking system which the American people and the industries and the states need, so they can continue to do the healthy business that they normally do in a normal way. We're simply saying, you may be bankrupt. We did this in the 1930s. On a lesser scale, but it's the same principle. You're bankrupt, but you sit there. Because you're there to serve the community on behalf of the United States and its people. You stay on the job. And you do the things you should do. And the things that you can't do, you won't do. And you won't make these disbursements. Because we're going to have to investigate this thing and decide who gets paid and who doesn't and how much. As you do in any bankruptcy proceeding, a constructive bankruptcy proceedings. You're going to decide who gets paid and who doesn't. And there are going to be a lot of trillions of dollars that are not going to be paid, ever. Because a lot of this was fake. So we're going to decide what was true and fake. And what is true will be honored as truthful values should be honored, and claims should be honored. What was fake was fake.
That's it. That's the way you approach it, because we can't have people, we can't have mass addictions. We can't have the structure of social life. We can't turn people into...
Like lice or rats running across the country looking for something to eat. You can't have the destruction of local communities. You can't have it. This moral question is outstanding. You're going to say, you thought you were bought into the United States. You thought you were part of the United States. You were part of our laws, part of our way of life. You are. And that's what's going to stay. Some other things are going to be changed. And what should be repaid will be eventually repaid. So we'll just freeze things until we can sort it out. In the meantime, life will go on. The money you need on credit and deserve, you will get. The house you live in, you keep. If you're an honest person, you haven't done anything wrong, you are not going to be penalized. We need you. We need you in the community. We need you to have a secure family life. We don't want your children to go crazy, get drunk, go on drugs, all this stuff. So you have to think of human values. Don't think of so-called rules made by some people. The fundamental principle of the U.S. Constitution is expressed in the preamble of the Constitution. That is the moral law of the United States, which is the highest law of the United States, the highest law of the Constitution. Every other feature of the Constitution is subordinate to that principle. The same principle is expressed in the Declaration of Independence, although with less elaborate effectiveness. In the Leibniz's concept, as presented against John Locke, remember, the U.S. Constitution from the beginning was a refutation, rejection of John Locke. Slavery was based on John Locke. That was the law of slavery. That was the law of the Confederacy. So we don't accept slavery. But that we do respect the fact that the government is the one which is responsible to ensure the continuation of the general welfare for ourselves and our posterity. That's the fundamental law that commands the U.S. government constitutionally. And we find ways within the structure of the Constitution otherwise to realize that objective. Faithfully the bankruptcy? Okay. The law of the general welfare, of what was called in ancient Greek agape, takes over.
Okay, the next question was received over the internet. It's from a Mr. Derek, and it reads, first of all, I'd like to extend congratulations to Quincy O'Neill and Juanil Inocentes for their victories here in California. I'd also like to thank you, Lynn, for your wonderful young people who took control of this convention and showed us all the way to impeachment. There was not a single person in attendance who could deny that it was, in fact, the LaRouche youth that set the tone for the entire weekend and directly forced those of us in the party leadership to put the removal of Dick Cheney on the table. My question is as follows. While I was at the convention, I noticed two jubilant figures frolicking about the halls and creating quite a stir. When I got close enough, I realized that these two boisterous friends were Dick Cheney and Al Gore. This was a stroke of genius on the part of your young people, and it left hundreds of onlookers at the convention completely confused and fascinated. For those who don't remember who Al Gore is and what he stood for, would you care to enlighten us on how he and Dick Cheney might find any common ground? Thanks, Derek.
Well, they're both fascists. Essentially, it's true that Al Gore, and I try to get it off the people. You ever hear this talk about this song, this country song from Tennessee about the company store? Huh? Now, who owned the company store? Who owned the company that ran the company store, which was notorious by this song, the company store? Al Gore, personally. Al Gore is essentially, he's a fascist. And he comes from the Tennessee swamps by pedigree. He's also affirmed racist. He's done things which he's guilty of as hell. In Africa, he's a racist. He's a killer racist in Africa. He's also listed as a Democrat. So are many leading members of the Ku Klux Klan. And he comes from that particular pedigree. I don't know if it's mint juleps or something else, I think. Anyway, this is what, at, you know, for me, where I was involved in the training of troops in Texas during World War II for a time, and we had people from all over the country, from the swamps of Brooklyn and the slums of Tennessee, to train. And I can tell you, they were a bit of a problem. They're crooked as hell. So, and I got to know the type. And I recently, in a couple of years ago, I was traveling through an area of northern Alabama into northern Mississippi. And I ran into police officers and others, and I looked at their faces. I recognized them as the same types that recognizes hardcore racists from my days in Camp Barkley in Texas in 1944. Well, we tried to train such types. We tried to toilet train them, among other things. It's true. So, and Al Gore is perfectly of that type. He's got the record. He is that. His father was, he got it honestly from his father. And this is the problem. The Cheney is the same thing. You know, Cheney is the lineman. They wouldn't let him climb the pole. He's too incompetent to be trusted up a pole. A fat slob, a football hero of his high school, who qualified as a bum, who was picked up out of the gutter by his wife, who's known for her bad taste, and eventually crawled his way into a position of great wealth in Halliburton as a thug. He has no brains. He's a thug. No particular intelligence, but he's a thug. He's an enforcer. And he's used as an instrument as a part of the package, together with poor George Bush, who cannot be blamed for anything, because I don't even know that he knows who he is. But anyway. Anyway, that's the kind of situation. This guy is no damn good. And anyone who's been in politics in the United States as a whole, as I have been, you know, has had the chance to meet different kinds of people in our country, our fair land, from different parts, has gotten to know the various types that exist. And you walk in, you smell this thing, and you know what you're dealing with. I cannot understand how anyone could be dumb enough not to know what Al Gore is after a fairly short exposure to some samples of his behavior.
This is another question received via email. This is from Sue Daniels, the financial secretary treasurer of the Smith County Federation of Labor and the former vice president of the Texas AFL-CIO in Frankston, Texas. Her question is, Lynn, I am perplexed. Why is the stock market going higher and higher each day, breaking records, while all our industry and standard of living is going to hell at the same time? We are losing hundreds of thousands of good, high-paying jobs. Foreclosures are skyrocketing. The world is going to hell in a handbasket. And the Dow Jones is breaking records each day. What do you think about this situation?
Well, you should recognize, being in labor, that employment in industries and agriculture has declined, and that casinos are on the rise. The stock market, U.S. stock market, is not a reflection of the economy. It's a casino. And it's run up and it's run down. Right now, the casino is being controlled from London, not from New York. The way it works is now is that the dominant financial interest in the world today is centered in London, not in necessarily the city of London itself, but in the British Empire. For example, the largest hedge fund operation in the world today is run out of the Cayman Islands. The Cayman Islands is the center controlled directly by the British monarchy. You take the case of Spain. You have two banks, the Bank of Bilbao and Santander. which are the biggest controllers, not only of the real estate bubble in Spain itself, which is now blowing up, but also are the biggest looters of South America, especially Brazil and the country, and Argentina and so forth, those countries. It's a looter. And this is around the world, is that hedge funds today and the finance associated with them control the world. The stock market of the United States is nothing but a joke. It's an ancillary of this casino. It's a subject of the hedge funds. It is not a representative of corporate, that's production, productive corporations, or of banking inside the United States. The banks of the United States themselves are the bodies which are being sucked dry by the hedge funds. The hedge funds are eating up the industries of the world, running away and leaving them like empty husks. And the hedge funds are going to go down. But in the meantime, the Queen of England, with these bunch of bloodsuckers called hedge funds, running out of little boxes instead of even offices in the Cayman Islands, is controlling the world, or most of it. And so, therefore, what happens is the British are now hovering on a decision. And the decision is whether to or not to collapse the U.S. economy and U.S. dollar. So, therefore, for the moment, in order to prop up the U.S. dollar, and to try, which is already ready to collapse totally, they prop up the stock market. Not by value, but by speculation, by bids. It's not real. It's like betting in a gambling casino. That's what the hedge funds are. It's betting in a kind of gambling casino. The world has been turned from a financial production economy to a gambling casino economy. It, what they do, they looted the auto industry. They looted it. They buy it. They put something into it to buy it. That was corresponding to the value of the industry? No, they looted it. They stole it. They parked the money and the profit for the stealing this place and then that place. They leverage the apparent value of stocks, which don't have that value in terms of if you try to close out on them and try to find out what the value is of them, they evaporate. So the whole thing is highly artificial. But the key thing is now the British have not yet decided to sink the U.S. dollar. And therefore, they prop up the U.S. dollar politically, temporarily, and try to manipulate the U.S. public by making, oh, the stock market's going up. The stock market's going up. You know, it's like watching the roulette wheel. You know, the stock market's going up.
Okay, the next question, Lynn, comes from Michael Balls, who's from Saginaw, Michigan. He's on the executive board of UAW Local 699, from the CAP program there. He's also on the board of directors of the Wanagas Federal Credit Union and is also a part of Big Brothers of Saginaw and Bay Counties. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I have several related questions for you. One is, do you have a plan for the United States to do something, even now at this late date, that could salvage the auto industry? I'm in Saginaw, and we are an auto town, and we're really hurting. Toyota is taking over. GM is losing market share, and we're losing jobs. For every auto worker in the United States who's put out of work, 5 additional jobs are lost. Now, Delphi is demanding that all auto jobs be downgraded from $26 an hour to $14 an hour, and this will further drive down living standards here. The housing market is dying, not only here, but all over the state of Michigan. Furthermore, people who have no hope have a tendency to turn to dope and to liquor. So we've seen young people and others as well more involved than ever with drugs and suffering from problems of hopelessness and low self-esteem. They feel that the future has been taken away from them. I've been a longtime member of Big Brothers in the county, and I have to admit that I am at a total loss as to what to tell these young people who I mentor. What is your message for them?
Well, first of all, we've got to demonstrate, as I think we tried to demonstrate in California recently, that there is a power turning loose and building up in the United States, which gives hope. This is particularly necessary after the shameless behavior of the Congress, particularly the Senate, in respect to my proposals for dealing with the automobile industry crisis throughout from the beginning of 2005. Here we were involved in the fight to save Social Security, which was conducted successfully. But then on the second issue, which I raised in February of that year, on this auto industry threat of shutting down, they did nothing, less than nothing. They didn't want to interfere with the hedge funds. And this was international, not just national. Now, if what I proposed at the time, as you may recall, was that it was obvious that the auto industry, in the sense of auto industry, was overbuilt as an auto industry. There had been a lot of fakery to maintain the charade of growth in it, but it wasn't there because it wasn't in the economy. And there was too much dependency on the automobile in the United States anyway, particularly with the way we were getting congestion with these super... like take the whole area of Loudoun County here in Virginia. It was insane. I warned them in 83, 84 that what they were doing was insane. You're developing a situation where you have housing speculation. How do you support the housing speculation? You make people travel from West Virginia to the Washington, D.C. area to work every day and back and forth. You create housing congestion. You try to maintain facilities to support the housing area. You have no local industries, no places of employment locally, no development whatsoever. You're putting up shacks where they put in tax on, even aimed properly. The whole thing may peel down and go down on you. They're going up to $700,000 average now. They will come down to maybe $200,000 or less. The bankruptcy rate is in there. It's in all over the place. So what we've done is we've had an insane structural approach to the United States based on speculation as in housing while destroying agriculture and industry. In other words, the way you run an economy, is, as you see in the state of Michigan when it was functioning, despite the auto industry's dominance, you had areas where communities were self-sustaining. And you could travel a short distance of less than a half an hour each day to and from work and from your functions. Or you had ways of public transportation you could get around without an automobile. And you had a self-sustaining, profitable economy, locally. And you would checkerboard a state with local economies, which were self-sustaining, and then you would put in their large economies, which would have a relationship to these local economies. And generally, you would divide the thing into divisions, where you would move the divisions one after the other, because if you get too much congestion, then you find you get a different kind of loss of economy. So to have economy, you don't take an area and say, let's make this a housing development area of a whole county, transforming an agricultural county into this thing with no sewer systems in it. That's what he did. And now expecting to save itself. Now what happens, the housing level comes down from the 700,000 bracket per unit, is aiming down toward the 200,000 level, which probably will bottom out at. But then who's going to pay the taxes? Because the tax revenue base is based on the real estate speculation, is not based, and the habitation, is not based on sources of income. And there will be no income to maintain the tax revenue base in the state or in the county. You will have a panic disintegration. So what my proposal was very simple, anticipating this nonsense going on, what do you do? Well, simply is you look at this productive capacity, which is organized. Here you've got communities. You've got people in them who are skilled. The community is somewhat balanced. You have schools, all these kinds of facilities. You have a state which regionally is balanced. So you take, stay where you are. Don't move. Live where you live. Work where you work. What do? We take the industries which are producing automobiles or components of them, and you say, what else can you produce? If we're producing too many automobiles to sustain this industry, what else do we produce? What about our water systems? The whole Ohio River, Mississippi River, is not developed. The whole system is breaking down. Who can make the things that fix that industry? Well, the automobile industry, machine tool sector can design anything for that or a great number of other things. Who can design new mass transit systems and build them? The automobile industry, machine tool capacity. All industries can be developed that way. How about some nuclear power plants? The same industry can make most of the components of that too. So therefore, we have present great needs for product which are not automobiles. We have people who are employed where they are. We want to keep them employed at that skill, at that present social standard of living at least, and give them a new product to make, which they can make rather quickly. A good set of design engineers assembled in that industry can produce almost anything within a year. It takes them about a year to go off the drawing boards and make a new product that works from design. So therefore, why do we let that thing go down? Well, because it was you have to now get at the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem was not inherent in some process, lawful process within the communities. It was inherent in what was going on in Washington. There was a decision to deindustrialize the United States. There was a decision to ship the auto industry out of the United States into other countries. And to eliminate, even when you produce automobiles in the United States, don't let them be produced by U.S. corporations. Let them be produced by foreign corporations in the United States, not U.S. corporations. So you fire U.S. people, or you downgrade them to one-third of the income they were getting to work for a foreign corporation, because they're begging for jobs, and they'll take the pay cut. That's what they did to us. So the problem here is essentially a problem of national perception of national interest and justice, a sense of caring about our people, a sense of what the alternatives that exist to deal with the problem, which they wouldn't deal with, because Felix Rahatan wouldn't allow them. I know, particularly, Felix Rahatan campaigned in the spring of 2005, campaigned against me on this issue. His argument was, we don't want another Franklin Roosevelt ever again. These are Franklin Roosevelt methods. That's what he's proposing. And you get every now and then you get some guy comes up, a crank like Franklin Roosevelt. A crisis comes, making a mess like a stupid government like this government. And the danger is that someone like him who is potentially a new Franklin Roosevelt, will come in and do the same thing that Franklin Roosevelt did. And a campaign against me by him was on that basis, and by others. And he's a fascist. Well, actually, him being a fascist, me being me, we don't get along too well, you know. But that's the problem. This is not a lawful problem, which developed autonomously, synthetically, or whatever, from inside the United States. It was a problem which was brought in from international interests, which are determined to destroy the United States. And they're destroying it by stripping it of our industries, of our agriculture, and our basic economic infrastructure. And it's being done deliberately. We are being murdered as a nation. And therefore, we stand on our hind legs and say, but I stand on your hind legs, you've got to specify the alternative to what they're doing to you. My alternative is go back to the same thing. While many of these people are still where they were, working, living, let us simply have the government step in with a credit program. Let us have an infrastructure program, building program. Let us take our requirement for a national transportation system, not rail, but something better than rail, which we can do. Let's deal with the problem of a shortage of power. Let's deal with the problem we can't get safe drinking water out of a faucet in most parts of the country anymore. Take care of the problem we don't have enough fresh water anyway in most parts of the country to deal with the needs in that area. Take care of many other problems which we can take care of by launching the industries which will pay for themselves over the cycle of their life. Put our people back to work for the missions which our people are capable of doing. Rebuild this country as what it was before these swine were decided to destroy it, especially with Nixon on. We have been destroyed deliberately. by a financier and foreign-based financier interests, beginning with the Nixon and the administration itself, and what followed. And that has become our tradition. Why don't we just assert ourselves and say, screw you. We are going to have our country back again.
Lynn, I'm going to move away from some domestic questions and entertain some questions that have been submitted by people here in the audience from other parts of the world. This is a question from someone associated with a local consulting operation called Executive Research Associates. And the question is, Mr. LaRouche, why is the Washington leadership, both Democrat and Republican, so hell-bent on destroying the nation of Sudan?
There was once a fat man called Lord Kitchener. And in 1898, he took an army of Egyptians down to get revenge for defeat of a British interest. There was a fellow called Chinese Gordon, who had been the local honcho and general jerk in that area. And the local constituencies had assembled themselves, and they had killed Chinese Gordon. And I had the privilege one day of standing in a building, which is the entryway of a building with stairs going both ways, and going up one wall on one stairwell, there's a plaque. And the plaque commemorated the place where the local inhabitants of Sudan had shot the hell out of Chinese Gordon. There was also the building where George H.W. Bush slept one time when he was vice president, or president of vice, or whatever that was. So I know Sudan fairly well. Sudan is geographically the largest country in Africa. It is a largely arid country, but it is also an integral part of the entire Nile system, which runs officially from what is called Lake Victoria, which is like giving the name of a urinal to a large lake. And it runs up as the White Nile, and joins the Blue Nile, and becomes the Nile generally, which goes all the way to the sea. And this is the area of an important water agreement between Egypt and Sudan and some other countries, particularly Ethiopia, in that area. It's an area which the British have managed from below Victoria, Tanzania and so forth, up all the way up on the eastern side of the of Africa. It's an extension of what the operation of the British Africa operation from South Africa before. It is also a geopolitical significance in sense of controlling all of Africa and also part of the control of the whole Southwest Asia complex. It has potential. Its main problem is water. There's a lot of water there in the southern part of the base of the Nile area, which could be managed. There also, of course, with modern nuclear power, fission power, we can generate a marginal increment of water in areas of agriculture. And any significant increment of the water supply in Sudan in certain areas would result in actually a very large improvement in the conditions of life of the whole area, because it has a certain potential. And when you add one element that's missing in a marginal potential, that turns a whole area which is desert and turns it into something which is productive. And that's the case there. We have people from Sudan and the adjoining areas who are experts in that area and know exactly how and what to do, given the resources. All it needs is this one boost, and it will pull it over the top, and it begin to go upward rather than down. And the problems there are largely, since the beginning, since Kitchener's time, what Kitchener did was put, or the British did under Kitchener, they put one local tribe in the south. And these are not really tribes in the normal sense. What happened is you had people who were driven out of parts of Africa, adjoining parts of Africa, would flee into a swamp area where they were fleeing from getting killed. And they formed associations, like gangs, which are called tribes. So the British, in their occupation of the area, after doing the obscenity of naming the lake of the area Victoria, what a thing to do to a lake. But they managed the area by taking this area of these little people, so-called, in this area of southern Sudan, and they played one against the other and against the Sudan as a whole. That's been their policy ever since 1898 under Kitchener. One time it was the Dinka tribe that was the controller of all of Sudan. Then they overthrew the Dinka tribe, which still stayed there, of course, in its back, and it got another tribe in. Then they went with various kinds of operations, which were ethnic types of operations of control and management and conflict, managed conflict, one of the tricks of colonialism. So in this process, you got an agreement. George Bush, when he became president, promised Sudan that things were going to be much better in Sudan under George W. Bush than they had been under Clinton. I warned my friends in Sudan at the time. I had a meeting there in January of 2001. And I warned them when they said, no, things are going to be better with the Republicans under Bush now. We have guarantees. I said, don't be suckers. They're going to destroy your country. Guess what's happened to Sudan since January 2001? Huh? They've almost destroyed the country. U.S. operations. Well, the reason they were hated Clinton was not because of Bill Clinton, it was because of, guess who? The vice president, Gore. Remember, Gore was the guy who, when Clinton was in trouble during this impeachment period, Gore was the guy who organized the bombing of a pharmaceutical plant, the only pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. Gore also, in terms of Central Africa, around Lake Victoria, Uganda, and so forth, Gore, together with Susan Rice and so forth, were among the worst pigs in the kinds of operations they ran in Africa and against the adjoining countries. The horrible massacres in that area were organized by interests which included Gore in that area, as well as George H.W. Bush, who got a gold mine out of this operation in Zaire, that kind of thing. So the game is that. So our job, in my view, is we have to, in the vital interest of the United States, you take an issue like this part of Africa, and you have to admit that Gore, as vice president, was a criminal on Africa policy. He's a criminal today. His whole program, this thing he's pushing on global warming, targets Africa for genocide. But many American Democrats say they like Gore's program, which I can't find much difference between Gore and Hitler, actually. Just Hitler was probably smarter, that's all. Maybe that's the less dangerous thing. But anyway, so this is the problem. And this is a fake. It's a British operation. When I was there the last time, in January of 2001, I saw the British agents and I saw the operation. I was there. I was on the ground. I know these people. I saw it. This is the way it works. So if I'm in a position of power in this country, political power, those problems are going to go away. Because I know where the body's buried. And I know where to bury it.
Okay, I'm going to take another question on Africa, and then we're going to come back to some questions regarding the United States. Lynn, this is a question that's submitted by a representative from Tanzania. He says, Mr. LaRouche, I'm from the eastern part of Africa, from Tanzania, and my question is, how will it be possible to use nuclear power when all over Africa there is an international effort to ban the use of nuclear power, using the argument that it can be used for weapons of mass destruction?
Well, first of all, a lot of people lie, you know. It's not relevant. See, Africa has been so looted. and the death rates are so high, and the death rates tend to be concentrated not in the areas of the poorest areas, but concentrated to a large degree, as in HIV, concentrated in areas of semi-urban population of the people with the greatest skill. There's some famous cases of this thing. So therefore, the problem you have is Africa lacks the essential infrastructure needed to begin to rebuild these countries, or to build them up again, because they've been destroyed a number of times, and to decolonize the whole area. In fact, like the case of Tanzania, or take the case of, go through a whole bunch of these things, they all come up the same. Now, the problem is, what we should do is the basic thing where Africa needs aid is not being taught how to knit or how to dig a dry well. Mm-hmm. What Africa needs from other countries, from the United States and others, is largely basic economic infrastructure. For example, Africa has the largest agricultural producing area. But the bugs and other problems get in the way. The net food product is short. If you dealt with some of these problems, you would find the food production would be higher, the net food production. Because most of the food that is grown is destroyed before it gets to market by bugs and things like that, and rot. So therefore, if you had some degree of infrastructure to assist people in an area to deal with these problems, which you know how to deal with. We know how to put something in plastic and gas it and all these kinds of things to get the bugs out. We know how to do that. And there are people who know that. But they have to have the ability, the means of the local industries which provide this assistance to agriculture locally to provide this problem. They don't have mass transportation. Without efficient mass transportation, which are not automobiles, they need railroads. They need water management more than they need some places need water. But all the areas need water management. You've got problems with these lakes. You've got things in the lakes that kill, that are dangerous, diseases and so forth. You've got to give them the means to organize themselves the solution. Because people don't organize well and develop by being developed. You don't give orders and instructions and handbooks or tell people how to develop. What you have to give people is the power to develop themselves. So what you do is you take on the things that they can't do for themselves, like basic economic infrastructure. You assist them with that, then you have created the basis where they can, in net effect, do something for themselves. And it's their development, especially their self-development, which guarantees their future. You don't take an ignorant population and say, oh, you got this thing, it's all good, all yours, great fun, do this, do that, do this. You don't do that because you haven't given them the self-development powers to deal with the problem in the way needed. So you give them the infrastructure and let local government struggle to educate and develop the people. And in the process of developing and educating their own people, they become able to govern themselves better. If you give them the infrastructure, which gives them the leg up to develop, like water systems, power systems, and things like that, that's what they need. They don't need advice on how to knit. They need facilities in getting the kind of power they need, the kind of mass transportation they need, the hospitals and medical facilities they need as institutions. That's what they need. Technological assistance centers that they need. But the essential thing in development is self-development of the people. And you have to make the distinction between what you have to put in to make self-development work and self-development itself. But in the long run, it will be self-development that will bring them out of the mess, not development delivered by the World Bank. And that's the way to approach it.
Next question is from one of the LIM leaders here in Washington who wants to ask the question from the mic. Wes, you want to ask your question?
Hi, Lynn. So I have a certain question regarding the conceptual approach to take when organizing around the strategic collaboration that has to occur between the United States and Russia, China, and India. One of the ideas that I've been trying to develop in my mind is this Riemannian, Vernadskian sort of conception, that the conceptual basis for that sort of long-term collaboration has got to be along the lines of the unique capability of man to transform the geological characteristics on this planet and hopefully surrounding planets for generations into the future. And that common characteristic has got to be what situates any sort of discussion on economic policy at this point amongst these groupings. But there are a number of different ways to approach it, and there's been a discussion amongst the LIM about what is the best way to approach this organizing around this sort of cooperation that we know has to happen. But there's another problem that comes up that's it's very acute in the Congress. I'm sure it's also in the general population. But you run into leading policymakers, particularly Democrats, who will respond ferociously, violently. They'll grow fangs, claws, when you dare to tell them that their conception of economics is wrong, and that it's the cause of what is the downfall of our nation. And usually the way that this comes up is what they'll say as well, you know, we can't stop globalization. And so the best thing that we can do, since there's all this money floating around out there, they say, they don't say where, but it's floating around out there. Right? And so the best thing that we can do is to go out and get that money. Right? And then once we get the money, then we can channel it into the social programs that are going to help the people. Then we can rebuild Katrina disaster area. Then we can get everyone health care. Then we can do this and that. Right? And, of course, the emotion that they have towards the whatever sort of emotion they have towards the general welfare in that regard is good. But the whole basis, the whole geometry with which in their mind that they're approaching this issue of economics, if continued, is going to destroy the United States.
Talking about a baby boomer, aren't you? Well, but no, that gives it away when you're describing the baby boomer mentality. Because the point is, the baby boomer, as I've described them again and again, they exist, they're around. You can, the specimen still exists. It is not yet the dodo. It may be becoming the dodo of the 22nd century. But right now, it's around in the 21st century as a residue of the worst aspects of the 20th. The point is, the baby boomer generation is a dodo. Is an egocentric who can't make eggs. It's a generation with no future, in short. That the problem is that we bred, as I've laid out, between 1945 at the end of the war, or after the death of Franklin Roosevelt, and 1956, before the February 1957 recession. We bred a generation of little kiddies born between 1945 and 1956 whose parents belonged to the so-called white-collar side of the population as opposed to blue-collar. And they were largely associated with the idea of the defense or related industries. We call it defense-related industries. And they were considered, because of the security arrangements and because of the educational program which was introduced in the social conditioning program, they were specially conditioned. They were conditioned with the idea that they were an elite. from the parents got the idea of being an elite. We are now in the defense industry. We have good security clearances. We can get important jobs in defense-related industries. And we are sending our children to good schools. We're living in good communities. We have a special way of living. We know how to behave ourselves so as not to get into trouble, to spoil what we're doing. And they raised the little kiddies. And this became known as the white-collar organization man generation of the 1950s. A lot of books are written about it. I was there. I know all about it. I've been there. I diagnosed it then. All right. So they were optimistic. We are the kings of the planet. We are coming. We're going. Our kids are going to be something you can see. It's coming down the pike here. Then in February of 1957, as I had warned some of these jerks from my consulting practice, the bottom dropped out. The auto industry, the white goods industry dropped dead. People have been in corporations getting $40,000 a year as prospective division managers were laid off and couldn't get $10,000, couldn't get five. So suddenly, the parents of what we call the baby boomer today, of the white collar generation, not the blue collar, but the white collar, suddenly went from ecstasy, we are it, we are the powers, we are going to make it, the other people are going to make it. Suddenly they got depressed. And so the baby boomer phenomenon, while the education corruption and so forth still went on, the parents' generation of the baby boomers, they were not so damn arrogant anymore. Because they lived through a recession, which is a fairly deep recession for them, from February of 1957 into 61. And that's why you define the baby boomer generation as the generation of people who were born between the death of Roosevelt and the 1957 recession, February. Because they were subject to a mass social effect in that compartment of the social stratum, which went through this specific experience, not only being brainwashed in the schools by crazy methods of education, but they were also infected by their parents' radiation of the belief, we are wonderful. Unlike these unfortunate creeps out there. So now they became the arrogant generation. Whereas the people who'd come out and where the parents were not so content, a little less euphoric, more down to earth. And you saw that in 68. That in 68 you would see the people who represented the baby boomer hardcore were really arrogant bastards. Whereas those who younger, their younger brothers and sisters, were a little more cautious about things. They weren't infected with this euphoria. As we saw the same thing with the baby boomers themselves in the United States between 1963 and 2000. From 1963 and 2000, the baby boomers, with the election of the first baby boomer president, Bill Clinton, thought they had arrived. This was now the golden generation, unlike any other generation. It was the wonderful generation. All other ideas and cultures were wrong. We had now come into our own. And this generation, under Alan Greenspan, put out oodles and oodles of phony money for the housing industry in new areas and also for the Y2K bubble. The computer industry. And this generation, they wandered around from 1993 to 2000. They wandered around until the late spring of 2000. They wandered around in a state of ecstasy. We are the wonderful generation, echoing their parents who had been baby boomers born between 1945 and 1956. So again, in the children reflected the same piece of insanity which their parents had had over 20 years before, 30 years before. And suddenly then, in 2000, it collapsed. And the baby boomer since that time has been vengeful, hateful, and depressed. And said, we want our money. Everything is money. Because that's what they believed from 1953 to 1990, 2000. We won! We are the baby boomers! We have a baby boomer president! We have now got a new baby boomer president, George W. Bush. He's also a baby boomer, don't you know? So the baby boomers think they're running the country. They control the Senate. They are a very powerful factor in the House. They dominate most of the business and related institutions of the country, to the extent they still exist. And they have this sense of this lost euphoria. They thought everything was wonderful. They had made, just like their parents, between 1945 into 1956. They had it made. I think they had made. It was taken away from them. They had won the golden, brass ring. They've been on the merry-go-round. I got the brass ring. I got the brass ring. I'm entitled to this free ride on the next turn. And the free ride wasn't coming. And so now they were resentful against the fact that the free ride had been taken away from them. And they wanted the free ride back. And that's what you're looking at. So therefore, how do you deal with this? Well, you say, what do you call such a generation in history? Is called a lost generation, or otherwise called a degeneration. What it signifies is that in such a period as now, you have to go to a younger generation which is not infected with this type of disease. Because the characteristic of the baby boomer generation is, we are the wonderfuls. There was nothing like us before we came, and there will be nothing like us after we're gone. We are a moment of miracle in history. Nothing like us before, nothing like us afterward. We are in heaven. Why aren't we getting the respect we deserve? So this is the problem. So what do you do in such a case? What do you do with such nuts? What you do is you go to a younger generation. See, some of us are not of that persuasion. Some people who are younger than I am in the baby boomer generation are also not of that persuasion. They don't believe in this crap. They believe that there's a better way of living, that we should return to some values that we had before in this country and should build on that. But they feel they're a minority in the baby boomer ranks. So what do? They say, okay, who do we go to as allies to deal with this baby boomer problem? You go to the generation of young adults between 18 and 35 years of age, principally. And you say, you guys are going to take over, aren't you? Aren't you going to take over as you grow older and develop your skills? Why don't you concentrate on preparing to take over? And in the meantime, why don't you practice it while you're learning? Then you have a force in society where you just simply have to make a shift and say, recognize that the baby boomer generation as a generation is a lost generation. It's a failure. And therefore say, okay, we can have the baby boomer generation around as long as they're not giving the orders. You know, they're feeble-minded people, shrill brooks, and so forth. As long as they're not giving the orders, we can tolerate them. We can find useful work for them. But we're not going to let them destroy the society in which we live and destroy our future. And that's what happened in California this past weekend, is the injection of young people. Here you have a mass of younger people, Democratic Party, the lower 80%, so-called, they're involved and represented in a convention. They want something. They want Cheney out. The leadership of the Democratic Party says, you can't throw Cheney out. We're not going to do it. We intervene with a youth movement, which intervenes to its representatives in the situation. We blow the lid off it. And suddenly, the cork is off, and the forces come out. And so the will of the people, as I said earlier today, the will of the people expressed itself as a leading force. And the baby boomer generation said, yes, sir. reluctantly, yes, sir. And that's what has to be understood. You have to lead the younger generation, 18 to 35. You must let them lead as the force which is the spearhead of policy shaping. Pull the baby boomers after them. Don't sit around waiting for the baby boomers to lead, because they'll lead you into the ditch. You say to the baby boomer, look, Mom, did you ever hear about drunken drivers? Now, what do you do when there's a drunken driver behind the wheel? You tell him to move over and let me take over. You're a baby boomer. That's like a drunken driver.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, as is often the case with these events, we've kind of run out of time, although we have not run out of questions. I will say that among the questions that are remaining here that have been submitted by people in the audience as well as by people around the country, the overwhelming, I mean, truly overwhelming number of questions that have been submitted are questions that, in one sense or another, Lynn has already answered, but which do address the question of the impeachment of Dick Cheney. And they are a really clear reflection of the impatience of the American people and of their leaders, of labor leaders, of local elected officials and others, to see that process get underway. There's one of them now. The other subject, which, you know, there seems to be a big disagreement on among some of the questioners, is the question of Alberto Gonzalez. And while many of the questioners admit that removing Gonzalez from office probably won't accomplish much, they want to do it anyway, because I think it is largely a question of frustration. Finally, we have an overwhelming number of messages that have come in that don't have questions attached to them at all, but are simply notes of congratulations, not only on the events in California, but above all else, notes of congratulations on the recent transformation of the LaRouche PAC website. And people have written in to indicate that the website has become just an indispensable part of their daily activity, both in terms of keeping themselves updated and of actually their being able to brief their friends. And since many of the people who have written in are themselves constituent and political leaders, you know, it's a sizable task that they've taken upon themselves. There are a few questions that I will give Lynn to take with him, you know, that he will probably answer in writing as time permits. Other than that, I'd just like to address our audience in saying that, in fact, I think that the effectiveness of LaRouche PAC and very specifically of Lynn's youth movement has really been reflected in the events of the past couple of weeks, and most notably in the events of the last weekend. I think that we have entered a different geometry, and I think that really in the immediate period ahead, not only here in Washington, but across the nation, anything is possible. One of the statements that Ms. Inocentes made in her address to the Filipino caucus in California was, she said, take my youth's vigor and use it to get things moving. And I think that the LIM has exhibited that they are willing to do that, and some people still have the presence of mind to respond by letting them do that. It costs money. I know baby boomers have lost a lot of money recently, but they still have some. And this is definitely the time to invest it in this youth movement and in the future by contributing to LPAC. Other than that, I want to really thank Lynn for taking the time today. I know he has an extraordinarily demanding schedule. And I think that today's remarks were extremely important for people here in Washington and for people all over the world who were listening. So I'd ask you to join me in thanking him and ask him if he has anything he wants to say in closing. Do you have anything you want to say?
I'd say one thing. Thank you. Have fun. Always have fun. Even if it hurts them.